Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, and thank you for joining us for this second of our Fright Fest specials. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on this edition, I'm chatting to writer-director Dean Capsulis about his debut feature, The Swerve, which was one of my personal favourites from this year's fest. In our short interview, you can hear me talk to Dean about the near decade-long development of the feature, the difficult process of finding his lead before landing on Azure Sky, who absolutely knocks it out of the park, by the way, and we get his reaction on the huge response it got from the Fright Fest audience online. Before we get to that, though, I just want to quickly remind you that the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. But now, on to the interview with Dean. Hey Dean, welcome to New Horror Express. We're here to talk to you about your movie, The Swerve. And just for the podcast listening audience, can you give us a brief synopsis about The Swerve, first of all?
The Swerve is about a woman named Holly, who is a mother, teacher, sister, daughter, wife, and English teacher. And an event happens, discovery of a mouse in her home. And it's the first thing that sends her spiraling into a descent into madness, period.
And having seen this film, it seems like a very personal film. What was the initial inspiration behind the movie?
Initial inspiration was I started off with a small sketch I did of a woman, and the caption was "Midnight in a Supermarket," and it completely evolved around the character of Holly, and she named herself and the events surrounding it, and a lot of it was much from personal experience. I grew up around a lot of very strong women, and as I discovered, as I matured, was that they were dealing with mental illness, some of them domestic abuse, onward, and it stayed in the back of my, I guess, in the back of my mind somewhere, and I have a very big appreciation for Shakespeare, Greek tragedies, and those ultimately came together, they meshed with that drawing, and I came out and wanted to tell that story.
It seems like you have a real awareness of mental health issues. I mean, the film very much resonated with me, maybe partly because I myself have suffered from depression. Mm-hmm. Often mental health in horror movies is used as a plot device or done in quite a glamorized way.
Yeah.
I'm sure that you were particularly conscious of that. It certainly seems that way.
Thank you. Well, yes, I did not want to make it an issue film. I mean, the issues are there. They're extremely apparent. But I wanted it filtered through my sort of love of cinema and literature. There's inspirations all over if you look for it. I didn't want to copy anyone or copy anyone's approach to such subject matter at all. So, I mean, you could see some, I see reviews reminding them of Requiem for a Dream or for Repulsion, on and on. And I admire, I like those films quite a lot, but I didn't want to copy anything like that. And I tried. It was of the utmost importance for me to bring respect to a subject of anxiety and mental illness and social isolation, which I think is more prevalent than ever. I mean, during the pandemic, I've seen, you know, reports of domestic abuse and anxiety and mental illness skyrocketing, at least in the US. Mm-hmm. I don't know about elsewhere, but
it's been, you know, similar in the UK here, certainly. It's been similar all over.
Yeah, it was very important to me to bring, you know, to be very empathetic towards that. Although I don't suffer from depression, I have, you know, anxiety. Certainly not as severe as some friends that I have, but, you know, I have dealt with it. And again, it was extremely important for me to be very, very empathetic and rational when dealing with it.
Now, this is a movie it's a heavy movie. It is a kind of gut punch of a movie. I think you saw my reaction to it on Twitter when I saw it at Fright Fest. I was shaken by it in a way that similar to A Requiem for a Dream or An Irreversible or something like that. Did you expect that was going to be the reaction?
I'm not. I'm laughing at this because because the process for me was so long to make a movie. I mean, it's taken years. It's a very independent film. I mean, it's very handmade. It was something that it was myself and the producer. We put this together with what we could. I mean, this is a long story in and of itself. So because I'm so close to the material, I was not aware, except that I felt it through the character. I was extremely upset. This is what I felt during the shooting of it. I knew as we got closer to, you know, because the last scene in the film, the last scenes, and I don't want to give it away, was what we shot in the film. That was intentional to get the actors prepped for this. But I didn't know the reaction would quite be that way until we initially started showing it, even in rough cut form. And when we were, it should be a fun story, hopefully, we met with some composers, music composers, before, you know, we went with Mark Corbin, who's just excellent, just a wonderful composer. There was one prior to him that we met with, and he basically ran out of the room when it was done. He was just crying. He was sobbing. And like, what happened? And he later let us know that he liked it a great deal, but he was very shaken by it. So that's when we started to get an indication of it. Like, okay. Well, it works. You know, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, a couple of questions out of that answer. First of all, how long a process actually was it? Because I noticed that the kind of on your IMDb credits, your last short was 2004. This is obviously coming out in 2020. And the second question was going to be about how did Mark Corvin, the composer, come on board to the project? Because I think his score is a big part of what makes it such a discomforting film.
Oh, thank you. Yes, the short, well, I've been making films since I was, I think, 11 with my, you know, my father's video camera. I mean, I'd never stopped. It's just that I'd been working in the industry before I'd left, you know, university in some form or other, whether it was in music videos, I was working marketing for a studio. And then I found that all rather, you know, not for me, wasn't right for me. Started made some short films, which is probably what you saw on the IMDb, and those were great. But I also had to get away and work on developing my ideas for a feature. And I think we've been working on, I'd written a number of feature scripts and nothing I really wanted to focus on as a directorial debut until the Swerve. And I actually had a sort of my teacher, I had a writing instructor at the time. And she was like, look, you gotta focus on something and this one's great, you should focus on this. And I did, and we brought it to some lab, film like screenwriter labs. And then that changed, you know, it changed considerably since then, just kept on and off working at it. And meanwhile, I worked as a graphic designer, you know, as a day job until we started getting everything together for the feature. And that took a long time. It took years. I mean, on and off, I think the whole thing was probably almost like a decade long process from like the first inception of it to the finished film. You know, on and off, it's not consecutive until like the last year or so, and then everything sort of snowballs and it takes on a life of its own and you know, overtakes your life and such. Oh, and then your second question was regarding Mark Corbin.
Great, the composer, yes.
Mark, again, I was interviewing other composers and we were like, this isn't right, you know, listening to the music. And I was like, you know, I'm going to contact, I think Mark Corbin would be perfect. And I sent an email to his agent, if I think back, and he asked for a rough cut of the film, and I sent it. And in all honesty, I thought, you know, this is a long shot because, you know, it's a small budget film. What's he gonna? I mean, you know, not that he works with big budgets, but you know what I mean. It's a very small budget film. Yeah. And Mark, we got an email back saying he wants to do it. So that's how it came to be. And then we actually, the producer and I we're in New York. So we went to Toronto, which is where he's located, and he's incredible. He has these instruments that he's made, like he's actually made these instruments, and it plays at least one of them during the film. We had a great time. It was perfect. I love his strings. That's the reason why I wanted Mark, was right. His string work was extremely important. It's what I wanted for the film. And the other folks I'd met with were wonderful, but their string work, it just wasn't right in setting a mood.
And thinking about other people who came on board on the project, how did you come to cast Azura Sky? Because obviously it's a brilliant performance, and that central performance as Holly is a taxing role, to say the least. So yeah. What made Azura your woman?
She, just to be perfectly honest, I recognized her, but my mind was, you know, in terms of like names, was elsewhere, and I didn't know her. It was the producer, Tommy Minix, who said, "Oh, she's great, Dean. She played Cassie in two episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and there's a whole cult around this character." And I said, "Oh, that's nice, but why is she right for Holly?" And so I saw an audition that she sent to the casting, an audition tape she sent to the casting director, Adrian Stern, and we watched it, and she was wonderful. She was really wonderful. And, you know, she did a scene aside from the script, and I thought, oh, she's great. And Tommy pushed me, and we spoke and got along well, and she has no affinity for psychological thriller or horror. She just, you know, she loved the role. And I said, well, the whole film is a role. It's written as you see it. It was written that way. And, you know, she committed to it. And that was that.
Given the kind of darkness of the material, what was the kind of atmosphere like on set?
Well, it's a movie set, so time is of the essence. So you don't have a lot of time to sort of bandy about. And but everyone was working very hard. It was a fairly lighthearted set, believe it or not, because of the heaviness of the material. But one thing and I've had this question before, and the thing about, at least with my actors, is they were very gung-ho with the material. I mean, the heaviest scenes were the ones they were most excited about playing, because they, and I, you know, having done interviews with Ajura, she was so excited to dig into these scenes. You know, she was prepped and I was prepped, and, you know, we went for it. I had nightmares about it for weeks beforehand on certain scenes. How am I going to pull this off? That's what my thinking was. But at the time of shooting, they were quite easy. The most difficult aspects of those scenes were technical. I mean, if there were any problems, they were just technical problems. You know, lighting, camera movement, focus, sound, you know, those are just as important, you know, in capturing performance and atmosphere. So I made sure that, you know, but with the actors, they were great, wonderful.
And in terms of the film, I mean, obviously you said you've done shorts and you've done various captured, doing different things in filmmaking. This is your debut feature. Did you feel that it was a step up at all in terms of filmmaking, going from shorts and the stuff you've done to a feature film?
Step up in which are you thinking of, a step up in what way?
Like just a bigger undertaking.
I could include any kind of profanity here, like to say hell yes. Yes. There was, you know, here's what popped into mind as soon as you, right when you said that, was a friend of mine who's a superb director, and he's completed two excellent features, sent me an email and he said, "So Dean, how are you doing?" He's like, it wasn't like making a short, was it? And ha ha ha. It was like, it was much different. It's an enormous undertaking. And I'm certainly not just talking in terms of shooting. I'm talking in terms of commitment to pre-production, production, and post-production. So you're living with it 24/7 almost, you know, it really overtakes your life. So you have to love the material that you're working with. You know, especially since this is my first feature, you know, it took 100% commitment.
Well, I mentioned that I saw it at Fright Fest. It got a big reaction from Fright Fest. What did you think of the reaction it got coming out of that festival?
We were very surprised. I mean, extremely happy, because I know that it's a challenging film. It's divisive. It's a kick to the teeth, a punch in the gut. But we were very, very surprised. I think Paul McAvoy is a genius for, at Fright Fest. Paul McAvoy is one of the co-directors of Fright Fest, for placing the film where they did. Very pleased, very pleased. I think it worked. And I love the festival very much.
Excellent. Well, we'd love to talk to you longer, Dean, but thank you very much for coming on New Horror Express. And we'd love to have you on again sometime whenever your next feature comes out.
Oh, please, please. We'll let you know of hopefully a UK release soon, you know?
Okay. Excellent.
All right. Thanks so much, Scott.
That was my guest, Dean, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show, as well as to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this special edition of the pod. As always, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Finally, be sure to join me again on Monday, when I will be chatting to yummy director Lars Dumasso. Until then, though, see ya!